going to tell us about?
Well, we'll see what I talk about.
Okay,
all right. So as far as I can tell, these things have two purposes, one of which is to introduce myself to you folks so that hopefully you'll come to my office and talk about something we do that's vaguely similar. And so I'll cover that purpose with a pre-talk, and then depending on where the questions lead, we can branch into one of a few places for the talk. So the things I work on include dynamics, particularly that of multiple planet systems. So things like planet-planet scattering, planet-disk scattering, look at the observations of multiple planet systems and trying to see what they can tell us about things like secular resonances, eccentricity distributions, and so forth. Another thing I spent a lot of time on for the last 2 years has been thinking about the sim planet searches and what they're likely to find, how that can be improved, and so forth. And something I've been working on recently is data analysis of both radio velocity and SIM programs, and in particular using Markov chain Monte Carlo to better constrain orbital parameters and possibly use previous observations to improve the scheduling and placement of future observations so as to optimize the return from both of those types of planet searches. And then a little bit of modeling the scattered light from different systems. Kind of most hypothetically and fun is Earth and kind of theoretical other planets out there. And now a little bit more seriously looking at KD15. So the ones that have check marks are the things that you can cause me to branch into. And I think there's only two people who have heard each of these check marks. So it's fair game for where the questions are. But I'll do a quick summary of each one just to get the question started. The first is talking about this issue of looking at the scattered light from a terrestrial planet. And what this is an image of the Earth and the Moon from Mars, taken by one of these probes around Mars. And you can see that here, of course, there's still a few pixel elements on this guy. But the interesting thing to see is that there's a large bright spot, and most of the light comes from a relatively small area. And so as the Earth rotates, you can imagine seeing some variability due to that. And The conclusion of that work was that there's large variability of the light curve as the Earth rotates across a day, and hence that's something that you could try to observe with something like a terrestrial planet finder mission in the optical. And the various things you might get out of that are things such as the rotation period, a basic idea of, are there oceans, are there clouds, are there land, are there ice? Things like that. And then on an annual time scale, things like phase functions, are there seasons? And then as you break it up further, going to kind of broadband spectra and then broadband photometry and then spectra, you can imagine trying to get out, is it sand or ice and so forth. So that's one pretty fun topic. And the next thing I'll talk about is some of the data analysis for the radial velocity searches. And the first point is if you look at the observations, these are of course taken from the exoplanet's website, there's a wide range in quality of data. So here you can see for 51 PEG, it's been known for years, it's gone around thousands of times, and we've pretty well covered that thing perfectly. But for some of these other systems, the data gets a little bit sparser, and you can imagine that it might not be quite so clean to fit orbits to those. And so, whilst I don't want to leave anyone the impression that all these orbits are bad, but there's a wide range, where here we may have a very precise orbit, here we may have only kind of a vague constraint on what's going on. Okay, I don't understand this. For whatever reason, Windows didn't want to show this, so I just kind of whipped out another window here for this one. But this is the radial velocity curve kind of messed up, I guess, for 47 UMA. And the points show the observations, the published observations, and the line, the solid line, shows the best fit orbital solution. And you can see that, it goes to the points reasonably well. But there's also a dotted or dashed line, which also goes to the points reasonably well. And I think that by eye, you can see it's hard to tell them apart. And in practice, I'll tell you that actually the dotted line goes to the points better. And as you can see, even though the inner planet has a very similar orbit, the outer planet has a very different orbit in those two curves. And so while it looks like that inner planet has a well-constrained period in eccentricity, the outer planet is still highly uncertain. And the reason is simply that it hasn't gone around but maybe one time or so. So there's pretty big uncertainty. And for another illustration, oh no, these dots didn't show up, I'm sorry. Is that other system I showed you in the bottom right that had just a few observations. You can look at, you know, where the published kind of point is, but then if you look at the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours for where the planet would lie, you can see they extend over a quite large range of orbital periods and eccentricities. And also you notice that they're highly correlated. So if you were to, say, do simulations, and this is when there's only one planet, but saying, you know, are things stable or something, and you were to draw a box that enclosed all of these, most of the phase space you sampled would be ruled out by observations. But, you know, if you draw a box down here, you're missing a significant fraction of phase space that's not ruled out by observation. And so the point here is, if you're going to do some type of analysis that depends on, you know, orbital elements of planets, that in many cases there are large enough uncertainties that you should keep those in mind when doing things, whether kind of directly putting in, say, planets into an n-body simulation to determine, you know, are they stable for some inclinations, or maybe less directly in something like comparing, say, an eccentricity distribution of observed planets to some model. So this was taken from a talk where I was illustrating the advantages of Markov chain Monte Carlo to, say, bootstrap methods. So I think the published errors are basically based on resampling something like a bootstrap, which are these red contours. But because of various potential biases, there are cases where that doesn't capture all what's going on. And these solid contours show the uncertainties that you get using Markov chain Monte Carlo. And the point that I'm sorry I didn't show up on this, I guess it's probably behind the figure, is that this is the published best fit solution. And then I emailed Jeff about this and said, you know, this is kind of a pretty large range here. And he said, yeah, you're right. We're going to take a few more observations in a month, and I'll tell you what happens. So then he put the best fit point up here. And since then, without me saying anything, the best fit point has moved about here. Sorry to the mic people. But the point is that it's moving around quite a lot, and also that you can see it's clearly, you know, permitting these solutions that Markov chain Monte Carlo found, which, you know, if you just kind of looked at the published error bars, you might have not appreciated that much of uncertainty. And so basically, one of the points I'd like people to remember and potentially talking about is that sometimes you need to pay attention to. Well, you might think that, but there's actually a little more subtle than that, and that is that often what you sample is when the planet either passes, you know, in front of you or at paracenter, and when there's a large dip in those radial velocity curves. I can go back up to that. Essentially, for this one, you can, you know, just kind of, I think the observations are something like, you know, it's not real, these points are the same as those points is the real issue. So, you know, you can kind of see that even though they may have some of these enough to see it turn over, you know, they don't really know when it's going to happen again. And so even though they may have a full orbit now, they don't know, you know, they don't have that second, and so getting the second large change in the radial velocity signature is what would really help them nail that period down well. And you know, that requires patience. And it's not their fault at all. I mean, for something like 51 Pegasi, you know, in 4 days, you can go back and just observe the thing and say, ta-da, you know, it fit. But if you have something that's, you know, on the order of 30 years, I mean, what are you going to do, not publish it for 45 years? I mean, that seems a bit unreasonable. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to, you know, publish and talk about these systems, but just when you do so, you know, if you're going to fit a model to things, you got to realize kind of the range of possibilities that are going on. Okay, so now the other thing I was hoping to talk about some was the Space Interferometry Mission, in particular its planet searches. And so just to gives people some idea of what this is likely to do. They're talking about surveying roughly 100 stars at 1 microarc second precision, and then a larger sample, maybe 1,000 stars at a smaller precision in a wide angle mode instead of narrow angle mode, about 4 microarc seconds. And the target list is something like A through M stars. So it's one nice feature of the surveys, it's a wider range of spectral types than they get from radial velocity surveys. And of course, one of the advantages, they can follow up the radial velocity systems and get things like inclinations and masses for the known systems. But one of the main purposes is a search to find new planets, in particular lower mass planets. And so just to very quickly remind you what happens is you observe the star's position again and again, and you try to extract from that an orbital period, an amplitude of the motion, which is roughly proportional to mass, and then from the shape of it, you can try to get out orbital elements. And there's a, if I look at the known extrasolar planets and just assume Sinai is one for all of them, then I can look at what's the distribution of the signature. This is just a scale to reflect how large the amplitude in terms of astrometric signal is. And you can see at 1 microarcsecond, nearly every most of the planets are detectable. But then in terms of actually being able to measure high-quality orbits, there's still a good fraction that are, but there's also a good fraction which would not be quite so sensitive with just astrometry. So the SIM planet searches are talking about something on the order of 20 to 50 observations per star at this 1 microarcsecond precision, spanning kind of minimally 5 years, assuming things work, of course, but hopefully 10. And the major goals are, again, to measure these planet masses and inclinations, particularly for lower mass planets that you can imagine might be terrestrial planets. But, of course, the reason they haven't done this is because it's hard. And so I'll point out some of the challenges that are unique to astrometry. And one of those is that there's, in radial velocity work, the first parameter is, what is the star's velocity? And so the first observation tells you nothing about planets. But on your second observation, if you notice that the velocity is significantly different than the first observation, you can say, hey, something's going on here. In astrometry, that's not the case, because instead of having one free parameter that's totally unrelated to planets, you have about five or so. You have a proper motion of the star, which causes it to drift across, which is now in two dimensions. You also have, in some cases, an acceleration. Sorry, a position and a velocity here. In some cases, acceleration, which bumps you up to seven. And then you also have this parallax effect, which causes these loops in here. And this figure on the left here is about 1 arcsecond, which shows the motion of a nearby star over the course of 5 years. You can just count the loops. And you'll notice there are two curves, a red and a green, at least for those of you that aren't colorblind, I guess. And you'll notice they're quite similar. And if anyone, you know, that's what they're going to have to tell with perfect observations, no noise. You know, they're going to have to be able to recognize that the green curve is a planet and the red one doesn't. And obviously, there's some concern about how you're going to be able to do that. But the good thing is that the precision is supposedly much more precise than the scale you see here. So if we zoom in by a factor of 1,000 and now put in, instead of this one Jupiter, we've now put in our solar system, we can see the path of the sun from several parsecs. And the thing I point out here is if you have a five-year mission, so say from 1990 to 1995, you get kind of this little loop. Right? So, of course, the problem is that Jupiter's in a 12-year orbit, so in 5 years you get a loop, half a loop. Now, if it lasted for 10 years, we'd come back over here. So maybe, you know, it's starting to close. But, of course, it doesn't close because there's Saturn, which also causes a significant signature. And so by the time you come over and have maybe 30 years of data, you can start to see pretty easily that there's a Jupiter in a 12-year orbit, Saturn in a 30-year orbit. But the problem is, of course, disentangling these if you have multiple planets means that very quickly, even with just two planets, you can be up to 20-something free parameters trying to fit all these guys. And if you have 24 observations, that's a little bit of a concern. So to address these issues quantitatively, I run a slew of simulations of SIM planet searches. So pick stars from plausible target lists.
Yep, before you go on, I've got one quick question.
Sure.
Have there been any astrometric detections of planets yet?
Well, yes, there's been many detections. I think at this point the role of astrometry has been limited to searches and in some cases follow-up of radial velocity systems saying maybe we've measured an inclination or a maximum mass, minimum inclination type thing. So, of course, the advantage is that by doing this in space, they hope to drastically improve the precision from going from milliarcseconds to microarcseconds. And hopefully that will really help.
Do you not believe this one claim detection defined guidance sensor?
So the GLICE-876 system, I would say that it would be nice to have more data to help us decide whether we should believe that system.
Come on, don't be a pussy.
Well, okay, so,
Another question, is there any prospect for improving the ground-based accuracy by one order of magnitude?
I don't want to say no, but I'm not aware of someone who has a plan to do so.
You don't think that large interferometers like Keck and Gould?
Okay, fine. Now, so some of the interferometers do have a chance of doing good work, but I'd say, well, that, yeah, sure. So they have a good chance. That, you know, of course, there's always the issue of, you know, who can either have their thing working or, you know, in space first, and you know, is it, how those things begin. Those are kind of, from a purely scientific issue, yes, those are promising. Of course, they have kind of some disadvantages being on Earth, things such as dealing with, you know, atmosphere. The Earth, you know, only rotates, so some places you only have certain baselines and so forth. But in principle, yeah, they also provide possible, say, if SIM explodes, then we'd have another alternative means of doing this. Yeah, if SIM explodes or something goes wrong, then there's a, my work won't be totally wasted for the next decade. So. No, it's not ridiculous, but I mean the data also is not. Right. You can imagine if they had some more data points, and then it might be a more valuable constraint than it is at this point. But in any case, so going back to kind of my simulations here, you can get a big target list that's plausible candidates, you know, worrying about things like fields of view and so forth. Then just randomly giving them planets according to distributions that are similar to those which we found for the radial velocity planets. And the one major assumption this is that I've extrapolated the mass function down from, say, maybe a tenth of a Jupiter mass to an Earth mass. So in some sense, you know, this could be very off. It could be either high or low. But I would say that you know, if you get a number which is, you know, if you find there are a very small number of planets you're detecting, then you'd say in order to have a significant number of detections, I need to have an even larger than I would guess from extrapolating that mass function. So that's the one possibly pessimistic assumption in these simulations, and all the other assumptions were meant to be a little bit optimistic.
So if you're basing on radial velocity detections, are you biasing yourself towards short period planets?
Well, no, because I mean I'm taking a distribution in say major axis, which is, you know, 1/1 you know, a, or, you know, equal in log p or whatever you want to call it. And so I'm extrapolating that out, I think, to 20 years or something, right? Which is kind of as much as you're going to hope that a 10-year mission is going to be particularly sensitive to.
But, I mean, the frequency and mass, and the mass and period distribution using is from Tabatnik and Tremaine, right?
Right.
Where they tried to account for the biases in radial
right.
velocity distributions.
I see. Okay. So, I mean, of course, we can't know what's at 20 AU, but at the same time, it's not like I'm putting all the planets in 3-day orbits because that's what they found, you know, half of them are or something ridiculous like that.
Well, what's the strategy? Are you looking for, say, sub-Jupiter mass planets, or are you looking for Earth mass planets?
Well,
it seems to be the strategy of my question.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And that was a significant part of kind of my work, was looking at different observing strategies and saying, you know, what would these various things find? And if you do have a particular desire, such as detecting the most total planets or detecting the most Earth mass planets, you're correct. Obviously, there are very different strategies you'd use. I think that may be a little more technical than I was planning to get into this, but I can be happy to talk to either you or other people about that a little later. And so in that step where I just kind of mentioned simulate observations, the main steps are you just, you know, put in all those variables, fit them. But then the key point is that for a small number of observations, such as Sim is going to make, the more sensitive way to detect a planet is to compare the variance, or chi-squared, of your observations to that which you expect based on the observational errors. But this is also a somewhat dangerous way to detect planets, because you're comparing the variance to what you expect your variance to be. If you've misestimated your errors, if the errors aren't Gaussian, if there's some systematic effect there, you risk, you know, detecting things when you're detecting a misunderstood noise in your detector, which is not very convincing. And so a more sensitive requirement is to say that not only can you detect a change in the variance, but really you found a best fit model and the chi-square is significantly reduced, you know, taking account degrees of freedom that are left after you've put in your fit parameters. And so I'll illustrate the difference between those two criteria. And this criteria, which has been used in the literature some before, and this more strict criteria, which I'm going to talk about as well. And then you can compare, you know, how did your bit due to what did you actually find. And very quickly, you know, what you find is you can masses, semi-major axes, and they're mainly a function of the signal. This is a ratio of the mass of the planet to the mass of the star and the distance of the planet to the distance of the star. And I've scaled out by the accuracy here to make it dimensionless. And then the orbital period of the planet. And then averaged over a bunch of less important parameters. And so first you can just look at for the known planets. I showed this before, showing that at the 1 microarc second level where you can start to detect things, most of the known planets are detectable. But then if you require that you obtain a fit that significantly improves chi-squared, then you're starting to get up to maybe the 20, 30 microarc second range, depending on your actual precision. And then you can start looking at the more interesting things, which are the unknown planets. So here I show going from, say, 10 Jupiter masses down to an Earth mass. And this is the cumulative number of planets you'd expect to find for a 1 microarc second mission. And there are a couple, well, there are several curves here. This solid curve here is for a 5-year mission just detecting them. And then these three curves here for various measures of getting masses and orbital to 30% or 10%. So somewhere in here. And you can see it, you know, you drop to 1 out at maybe tens of Earth mass, you know, 10 Earth mass planet. And now with a 10-year mission, you can take this solid curve for these somewhat optimistic detections, and then going for actually measuring things like periods and masses, you can go down here and you find that you drop to 1 at maybe 3 Earth mass planet. And so my firmest prediction is that the definition of an Earth mass planet in the sim literature is likely to rise. But well, so here I've kind of broken this up into lots of things to confuse you all. But here on the left is just if I look at all planets. This includes, you know, up to 10 Jupiter mass guys. And this is if I take, say, planets less than 20 Earth masses. So maybe there's a chance it's a rocky planet. And down here, this is kind of, you know, getting significantly close to Earth mass planets, less than 3 Earth mass planets. And then the different rows depend on, this is a detection saying that I've measured a variance wider than I expect. So if you really understand your noise, then this is a detection. And these rows show if you actually want to measure an orbit, a mass, you know, to various accuracies. And the thing to note out here is that once you start to get into these, say, 3 Earth mass planet range, there's a significant probability of including 0. And so that's a little bit of an issue. If you are a little bit more liberal with your definition of Earth mass planet and start talking something like 20, well, then you can see there's a good chance you'll be able to actually measure things for a few of them. And so that would be very nice. And to now kind of contract back to a small number of things that you can easily look at, I'm just showing 2 sigma errors on each of these parameters. And you can see that, again, you know, small numbers are included out here. And so what I'd like people to take away from this is if SIM is going to justify its kind of, you know, SIM should go because we need to find low Earth mass planets, they need more observing time because, you know, this is kind of, you don't want to have your half your support be based on something that may include 0. One thing is, well, again, there was this one possibly pessimistic assumption that maybe Earth's, you know, I extrapolate the mass function. So here I said, well, what if every planet has an Earth at 1 AU? So now you can't say that that's pessimistic anymore. and you know, it's better. but it's still not so much better that, you know, a null detection is of somewhat limited value, I would say. And then the natural question is, well, how much more observing time do we need to make this really worthwhile? And so now, it helps a lot if you were able to have your mission last 10 years. But you know, either way, you can see that as you increase the number of target stars, particularly for 10-year missions, the number of these Earth mass planets, you know, it's not completely leveled off here. You know, down here, it's pretty pointless to observe in more than a few hundred because as you observe more stars, you have to go further out. And that means that you know, as you're looking further away, the observed proper motion of the star is smaller. And so, you know, this is sublinear, as you expect, but Over a 10-year mission, you can see that getting out several hundred stars still does help your odds of detecting guys. And so I would encourage people to support more observations, more time if SIM goes to planets.
Eric, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
How many hours per star are you assuming here?
Let's
assuming 24 hour, 15-minute observations?
24 observations. I think they're actually, okay, but they're grouped in about an, yeah, that's about right. Yes, it is. So right now they're talking maybe 10% of SIM time would go to these narrow-angle planet searches. And that's, you know, split among two groups. And depending on how many observations per star and so forth, it's 100 to maybe 200 stars in your target list. And I guess one point I've tried to make is that it helps a lot to have more observations per star because, you know, especially if you, say, have two planets around one star, you have, you know, 14 parameters related to the planet, you have 5-7 parameters related to the star, you know, you have very few extra observations in there that you'd really like to check. And so one point I've made is that I hope people will have more observations per star, but of course the problem is that reduces the number of stars, and I want that to be higher too. So the conclusion is 10% of time really isn't enough to detect Earth mass planets, such that if you don't detect them, a null result is significant. And since SIM isn't something that you can just, you know, decide to redo, like maybe, you know, oh, whoops, I should have observed more M-type stars in my radial velocity survey, I'll go add them to my target list. You know, you need to think about that in advance and make hard choices between other science, you know, that obviously would also like that time. But I've been trying to encourage people to realize the importance of giving SIM a significant amount of time. Let's see. Oh, good. There's plenty of time. You can see some of the other stuff. So I'll go through this a little bit quickly. Another thing that I spent a lot of time on is planet-planet scattering. And if we look at this favorite plot here of, say, major axis and eccentricity, you can see, and of course the circles are all the planets, and the size relates to the mass. There's a broad range of eccentricities out here. And you might wonder, you know, why do we have these large eccentricities? And
Those
had multiple planet systems, right? And of course, as everyone here knows, everyone has their favorite theory for how to cause all this to happen. The thing I'm going to talk about is down here, this planet-planet scattering scenario. And so there's been a good bit of work by several different people on it, and I'll try to emphasize actually some of this work on two planets of unequal masses, which I think is somewhat promising. Oh, whoops. What just happened there? Okay, so one complaint I've heard sometimes is, well, why would we have unstable planets? And I really don't think that's that big of an issue, because you can imagine these planetesimals start to form, they don't know the mass that they're eventually going to acquire. And so even if they somehow know to form at places where they are stable from each other, if they don't know how much they're going to acquire, once they increase in mass, they may no longer be separated. Another thing is that if they're forming in a disk, the disk can keep eccentricities low. After the disk goes away, if you excite eccentricities, you can imagine, then they can interact then. And of course, since everyone here seems to want these things to migrate, well, if they're migrating around, then certainly one way to halt it is to have another planet start causing large, significant scattering. And finally, I'll point out that these are simulations where they take 100 planets initially, and they evolve them forward, and what they're typically left with is two or three planets. Now, it's not entirely the same, because the two or three planets they're left with often have significant eccentricities, and the work I'm going to talk about is starting planets on nearly circular orbits, so, you know, it's not the same. But the point is that, you know, kind of your generic configuration of a bunch of stuff tends to reduce itself down to two or three guys in stable orbits. And so, just brief simulation of what goes into these experiments. You have a star and two planets, and they're placed slightly inside. For two planets, there's a nice stability criteria, so you can place them inside that limit. They're not guaranteed to be unstable, so occasionally you waste a lot of computer time, but it's not too often. And put them on reasonably circular coplanar orbits and just integrate until something happens. And the most common outcomes are they collide with each other, or one planet gets kicked out to infinity. And of course, sometimes you just give up. We tried that, not too often. And so the old result from the initial simulations where we had equal mass planets showed that if you have a planet at, say, 5 AU and with one Jupiter radius, that, so I guess that's that here. Where am I? These are collisions, right. So then there are a lot of collisions and a relatively small number of cases where you have one planet ejected. And the collisions give you nearly, I mean, you're basically putting two bodies back together, so the masses or the eccentricities and inclinations stay not too different than what you started with, but in the case of an ejection, you can get a significant eccentricity. And so one of the problems with this mechanism was if things were starting at 5 AU, you get a lot of collisions. It was avoidable if you say, well, somehow that you know they're starting at closer to 1 AU, maybe that since that's where we're seeing them now, and that's where the dynamical instability occurred, then maybe you could get significant ejections, but it was a little bit tough. And I'll skip through these. These are just little showing you what happens typically in these guys. And so one of the problems was, is so we looked at the observed eccentricity distribution of extrasolar planets, you know, excluding the ones that are very close, and compared it to the eccentricity distribution we got. Well, it's very different, right? There's kind of a large number of planets out here with these eccentricities near 0.5, 0.6. And so that was not too appealing. So the collisions are more frequent than the low eccentricity planets, and the ejections result in a narrow range of eccentricities than you typically get for the known planets. And so that led us to look at scattering two planets where you have different masses. And now, unfortunately, you have a few more parameters. You have a mass ratio, obviously. You also have a total mass, and then you have to worry about planet radii. But the nice thing is that the results mainly depend on one variable, and that is the mass ratio of these two planets. And the firmest prediction I'll show you is that the maximum eccentricity of this thing is predicted to be, whoa, what just happened here? Okay, out of order here. Okay, so now I'm going back looking at the relative frequency of collisions and ejections. And so the solid lines here are ejections, and the dashed lines are collisions. And you can see that if you, put a planet out at 5 AU, one Jupiter mass, then you have something like, most of the time you get ejections, occasionally have some collisions, for these extreme mass ratios. This is an extreme mass ratio of 9, right? And the equal mass ratios are similar to they were before. And you can see that what this means is that if you have unequal mass ratios, you can get a lot more collisions, a lot more ejections, less collisions, have less planets left on nearly circular orbits, and as I'll show here, a wider range of final eccentricities. So here I show the final eccentricity after you've ejected a planet, and these different curves for different mass ratios. And as before, when you just have equal mass planets, the eccentricity distribution is out here near 0.5, 0.6. But if you go to these different mass ratios, you can start to get significantly smaller eccentricities.
Why?
It's just conservation of energy and angular momentum. You can see that this must be. And actually,
what's the planet that's left, the heavier one?
Typically, the heavier planet is left. And it occurs very sharply, actually. I mean, maybe 10% difference in the mass is enough to strongly favor the more massive planet sticking around.
Eric?
Yeah?
What happens after the planets collide in your model?
Well, when they collide, you can conserve momentum, not energy, because, of course, there's going to be dissipation. And from that, you can figure out the orbit of the resulting system. And typically, they're in small eccentricity orbits. Right? And obviously, they are wherever they happened to be when they collided. So their same major axes are comparable. They're both on circular orbit, so their same major axis is comparable to what you had before, kind of averaging the two in some inverse way. But then the eccentricities typically don't grow more than by a factor of two.
So you treat them like elastic scattering.
Right.
That's
right. So maybe I should have emphasized that more. But the point is that when you have these collisions, you result in nearly circular orbits, and you're not going to produce an eccentricity of 0.5 by colliding those guys. Whereas at least if you start on nearly circular orbits, you get the final result is nearly circular orbits. Whereas with ejections, you can start with nearly circular orbits and end up with one guy on an eccentric orbit, and that's. And that's the kind of thing that we're observing, and so you can try to see if that's plausible. Okay, here we go. Well then, I'll wrap up and just say, that if you make kind of a crude conglomeration of all these guys, and of course this isn't an attempt to fit or anything, that you can get a reasonably comparable eccentricity distribution by combining a broad range of mass ratios, assuming the planet's masses are not influenced by the mass of the other planet. And I guess that's plenty good to finish up on. So.
Mm-hmm. If you introduce multiple planets, then the game becomes, I guess, perhaps a little less optimistic than what you have shown. Have you tried that?
Yes. If you just put in a kind of multiple planets in the simplest way, the detection thresholds go up by about a factor of 2 in terms of the amplitude signal you need if they're widely separated in periods.
But if they are not, then if you fit for one planet, the other looks like noise.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so there's some configurations that are very hard to get, whether they happen because the planet's near 1 year and there's parallax, or near 2-to-1 resonance with another planet where you can simulate eccentricities. So there are some configurations that are hard to get. But if you assume that things like 2-to-1 resonances aren't too common and give them a wide range of distributions, then the required signal you need goes up roughly by a factor of 2. It depends on things like periods, and once you get close to the life of the mission or close, it varies. But of course the problem is that most of your planets, especially in the Earth mass range, you are kind of barely detecting. And so if the common configuration, instead of one Earth mass planet around every star, is 2 Earth mass planets around every star, that's both optimistic and a little bit scary, because now you may detect that there's something there. It's not consistent with just your expected noise, but what? So certainly that is something that's a little bit scary. But
what if the most common outcome is a Jupiter at 5 in a year and the Earth at 1 in a year?
Oh, that's another interesting scenario. Is what if we put those? And again, the good part is that those, the signal to Jupiter is on a sufficiently long time scale that even if, say, you have a 5-year mission, it's a 12-year, you can sort of fit out, say, well, there is something far out. I don't know whether it's in a 12-year circular orbit or a 40-year eccentric orbit, but I do see the short-term variability. And again, the simplest thing to tell you is the necessary signal for detection of the Earth mass planet goes up by about a factor of 2. And again, if you're pretty interested, I can show you these four-dimensional contour plots and whatever. But the main thing is that, yeah, it is hard. And actually, the most interesting case I found was, what if the constellation is Jupiter in a 3-day orbit and Earth mass in 1 AU? Because there what you have is essentially a noise source, which SIM is not very good at detecting, because it's going to have, say, just tens of observations for several years. There's kind of aliasing. Is it at 3 days? Is it at 6 days? What's going on there? And for that, the good news is that Jupiter at 3 days is easily detectable with radial velocities. And even if it's some type of star that's hard to do, you can probably get out a period or something. And once, even though radial velocities don't get all the orbital parameters, they get enough that they can help SIM a lot. And so combining radial velocities and astrometry can get kind of those multiple planet systems where you put a guy close, but of course they can't do it when the Jupiter's, or at least they're not nearly as helpful when the Jupiter's in a 12-year orbit. So those are a little bit, certainly that could also significantly reduce the number of Earth mass planets you find. Andrew?
So, yeah, please, you've shown that you can get the eccentricity distribution with ejections. What about the semi-major axis distribution?
Well, that depends on the semi-major axis you start with. So
if you imagine that there is at least some planets that you have to move in a significant distance, is that possible to do?
If you do purely n-body dynamics with two bodies and kick out one, you're not going to move the remaining one in by more than a factor about 2, because it's the lighter one that's typically ejected. Now, the exception to that is if you get an extremely eccentric orbit, which can then be tidally circularized. And as Scott was talking about earlier, that can maybe a desirable feature. The amounts of that happen for the two-body, or two equal mass planets, were too low to match observations. For unequal masses, it's more interesting. And one possible problem is that the simulations that I used, since it wasn't enough to work for two equal mass planets, I didn't my simulations attempt to be able to model things with small paracenters well. But it looks as if it might be a few percent and enough to be significant compared to the known hot Jupiters.
Could you circularize with the disk that might still be there?
You can imagine, you know, circularizing with the disk, circularizing with the star while it's still on the pre-main sequence. Right, there's a slew of possibilities. But unfortunately, that's something which, you know, is very modeled. You know, where I say I start my planets turns where they end up. So it's not a very firm prediction. Unlike something like a maximum eccentricity of 0.8, which, you know, no matter what same major axes you start me with, if there are two planets in nearly circular orbits, that's the most I can get. So it's not a very firm prediction.